Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is journalist and editor Bob Koller. Since 1999, Bob has written a column that has been nationally syndicated by Tribune Media Services, which is part of the Chicago Tribune. He says, the column started out more personal and political. Then post 9/11, as the Bush administration unleashed its war on terror, he became increasingly focused on current events and refers to the column as part political brawl, part secular prayer. Bob Koller has won awards for his writing from the National Newspaper Association, Suburban Newspapers of America, and the Chicago Headline Club. He also authored a book called Courage Grows Strong at the Wound, published by Xenos Press, which is a collection of his essays fused into several narratives. Bob Koller, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Helen. Glad to be here.
Now, Bob, you say it started out more personal and political, your columns. Would you like to extrapolate on that and tell us what exactly you mean by that?
Okay, sure. Absolutely. Now, the kind of journalist I am is someone that does not denigrate the personal. I think there's never any escaping from it. And so even when I'm writing a political column, I feel like it's personal.
Well, what do you mean denigrate the personal? You mean denigrate yourself?
I think the way journalism is often practiced and taught, the self disappears, and we simply, you know, write with this alleged objectivity, you know, of which there's no such thing. And what we do is we get rid of all our wisdom, all our sensitivity, and we record what, you know, people say. Now, there's nothing wrong with being, you know, with listening to people and talking to all sides. That's very important. But we can't let go of ourselves and our wisdom and our judgment as we're gathering a story. Mm. Now, when I started writing the column, I've been a journalist for 30-some years, and so I've done all kinds of reporting, mostly in the Chicago area, which the whole world passes through Chicago, so it's kind of like covering the world. But when I started writing this column, it was shortly after the death of my wife. She died of cancer, and I had a teenage daughter. Actually, she was 12 at that time.
Oh, dear.
So just, you know, not quite a teen. And so the column was dealing with all of this, the loss, the grief, the death, mm-hmm. and the sort of the circus of single parenting a teenager, and the total craziness of that, and I just wrote about it. So it was a very slice of life, personal stuff. But you know, it wasn't limited to that. And I wrote about culture. I looked at the world around me and reflected on it. In many ways, but slowly I edged more and more towards a political focus. And after 9/11, which is hard to believe, it's almost 10 years ago now, I fell off the edge, and I just could not really go back to personal column writing at that point. The world just got too crazy, and you know, we started bleeding, hemorrhaging all these terrible wars, and I was one of the few voices that had sort of a mainstream forum that was against the war right from the start. And I just did not feel that there was any way that I could let up on trying to counter what we were doing, 10 years ago, and what we are still in the middle of today.
Well, I'm sure, Bob Koehler, that your readers were fascinated by your personal insights, because I think many people are a bit mixed up and a bit lost, and I like it. I like reading someone who's being truly honest with their feelings, having gone through a dreadful thing like
right.
losing your wife and the intense and bitter grief associated with that, and then the agony and ecstasy of bringing up a teenage daughter, which...
That's exactly what it is.
I've got a teenage granddaughter, and by God, she's awful, and yet sometimes she's just divine. But
absolutely, absolutely.
Much of the time, I mean, she gets up in the morning. How are you, Rachel?
Yeah, I know. At one point, realized what I have here is an umbilical attachment to my worst critic. There's absolutely no escape from it. You know, we're driving somewhere. Why did you go that way, Dad? And that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah. And she must have been going through the grief too.
Oh, and of course. And then that was compounded by the grief.
Oh, dear.
I was the only one that she could take everything out of.
Yeah.
You know.
She's
a nice young woman. Always was nice, polite, and a good student. But on Dad, she could unload.
How old is she now, Bob?
She's 25.
And has she turned out all right?
Yeah, she turned out great. She's an artist, and she's living in Baltimore with her boyfriend. She's working a couple of jobs. She's studying stained glass work making, as well as other drawing, she was an art major in college, and so she's continuing her art. And she's also a really good writer, I think. I think she could go that direction if she wanted to as well.
And are you too close?
Yes, we are definitely close. Mm. We talk frequently, not every day, but we talk, you know, quite a bit. I mean, a couple of times a week. And, I would say we're very close, that we have gone past the separation period.
The rebelliousness, as they call it in America, the individuation period.
The individuation period, right. She is individuated, she's on her own, and she's, you know, relatively independent.
Yeah.
So that is then allows her to, you know, be a, you know, real person with me. And, it's the joy of my life.
Well, can I ask you a personal question? Have you found, I mean, I know what grief's about. I've been through it myself in various stages. But have you found peace now, Bob?
I would say yes, I have found peace. Peace is always a temporary thing.
Yes, it is.
But, I mean, the peace, I think I had peace right from the start in one sense, in that I never felt that grief was the enemy. Mm. If I felt kind of a welling up of grief, there was also a welling up of closeness to my wife.
Mm.
And it didn't feel like a bad thing.
Mm.
Writing became my vehicle for living with myself, because there's so much excess emotion that comes from something like, you know, the loss of a loved one.
Mm.
And what do you do with it if you just go same old, you know, and here's the day and da-da-da, and then you get all this emotion and it feels wrong. But with writing welcomes that emotion.
Mm.
And when my place of work, I was an editor at the Tribune Syndicate, Tribune Media Services, and had been trying for several years to kind of open the door, you know, to let them allow me to do writing as well. I mean, that's my love, even though I'm a good editor. And they had a small in-house publication that they put together in-house that went to the smaller markets, you know, like weekly papers and Shoppers and all that. And so while a lot of the stuff was sort of fluffy, they did have a serious column in that mix, and they let me start writing that column. And so my first, you know, audience was, or my first clients were, weekly, small weeklies, Shoppers, very, very random, not the glamour kind of journalist, you know, outlets that a journalist would seek, but it was all right with me.
And now, do you currently write a weekly column for the
Yes, I do it every week, yep.
Good. All right, well, now, the first question that you posed to be asked for yourself is, what is peace journalism? Would you like to talk about that, Bob Kohler?
Okay, sure, absolutely. A few years ago, I mean, the term, I did not invent the term. It's actually, this is an Australian organization. I don't know if you know Johann Goltang?
No.
But he's somebody you might want to interview at some point. But they have a website called transcend.org that I forget exactly how I heard about it, but that is one of the things that they talk about on that site it's a peace education site, and they talk about peace journalism. That was the first place I had heard the term, and as soon as I, you know, saw those words written out, peace journalism, something kind of resonated, you know, lit up like a Roman candle, and I'm going, that's what I am, and that's what I've been for basically my whole career. I'm wrestling with how do I define it, because I don't define it in a simple way. But obviously, peace journalism begins with the idea of talking to all sides, in if there's a conflict of some sort. Now, that's just regular journalism as well. That's just, you know, called fairness. Mm. And people, you know, and many journalists, certainly that is the aspiration, to practice that, or at least pay lip service to that. I think peace journalism goes a little beyond just that imperative. And I would define it as it's writing the complex story instead of the simple story, especially around the idea of a conflict.
Well, give us an example.
All right, let's see here. Let's just talk about Rupert Murdoch for a second.
Yeah, we were going to get on to Rupert any second.
Yeah, I mean, there's an, you know, because that may be, you know, start to, well, no, I know. Here's a better example. Going back a week ago to the horrible tragedy in Norway.
Yes.
And what is the peace journalism take on this story? Well, of course, this is an enormous story with enormous ramifications, so no single story, you know, will ever get at, you know, you know, the whole thing, you know, unless it's the length of a book. But peace journalism begins by looking not at who did it and what was, and how bad this person was. Not that that's not important. I mean, who did it, of course, is important, and why they did it, but I mean why they did it in terms of their own discussion of a political agenda, and the killer, you know, had a crazy sort of, a neo-crusader political agenda and all that. Peace journalism has to look deeper and bigger at this picture, at the roots of violence. And when I wrote about this last week, I used the term that, talking about the violence, that the violence, first of all, was a product of some psychosocial kink in the human condition, some dark temptation or some dark permission to do evil in the name of good. This is the permission that I think a peace journalism always has to confront. And so whether the story is something as big as a mass slaying of young, you know, children or teenagers, like the Norway shootings, or a conflict between two neighbors, or a crime story, it's not, you know, most coverage begins and ends with who did it, you know, did they do it, You know, what's the evidence against them? I mean, it sort of allies itself with the justice system.
Well,
punishment.
Yeah, I'm interrupting you here, Bob. I think what you're talking about is really the medical model. And the medical model looks at etiology. Etiology is the term we use for the cause of a disease, i.e., we couldn't cure poliomyelitis until we found the virus. The cause of infantile paralysis was the poliovirus. And when we found the poliovirus, we could then isolate it and immunize people, so we virtually eradicated the disease. So what you're looking at is the etiology of the mass violence induced by this particular individual. So you're looking at his psychological motives. That's what you're looking at.
And yes, the psychological motives and you know, but more than just psychological in the sense that it was isolated to his individuality. I think there's a social, that's why I use the term psychosocial.
Yeah.
So there's an individual psychology, an individual, permission to kill someone, but there's a social permission as well.
Yes.
This is what concerns me.
Yeah, I think a lot of, well, he's clearly, he's a psychopath, this man.
Yeah,
Where there's a split between, and the definition of schizophrenia is a split between reality and perception of reality.
Right.
But what you're saying is that society gave him the credibility and credence to do this. And I've been reading about this man, Frank Gaffney, who has said some really rude things about me. He called me a fossil a few years ago.
Okay.
God damn him. But have you been reading about Gaffney now and his incredible antipathy towards Muslims and his sort of nurturing of the anti-Muslim, anti-Islamic sort of flavor that's going on in America now and probably in Europe?
Well, okay, now I have not really, I'm not up to date on what he's
right.
doing.
Okay, well, that's a side thing, but
yeah.
I'm very interested in what you're saying, Bob, because this man had a deep psychopathy.
Yeah.
And was given, it was legitimized by him grabbing on to something in society which society had condemned, which were the Islamic terrorists, and then that dates back to 9/11 and all the things that have arisen since then.
Right.
But then, you see, what gets me is that although he murdered 78 people, in America, the whole society is geared to hating an enemy, depersonalizing the enemy, and it's always he.
Always he, yes.
He. And so America's spending over $1 trillion
Absolutely.
On murder, and it's murder, it's killing.
Yeah,
and,
I agree.
And so depersonalizing, you know, I love the way they use insurgents. What the hell is an insurgent? In Afghanistan. And then they're droning them, you know, they're shooting them from little consoles in, you know, in San Francisco or someone where someone presses the button and then down comes the missile from the drone and kills a wedding family or something.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I think that from the personal, which you've so clearly enunciated, the psychopathy which is legitimized by societal hatred onto a sort of another foreign tribe, if you will, that then can be extrapolated to the tribe of the United States, for instance, which draws in other tribes to support it.
Right, exactly. I agree with you completely. That is my analysis as well.
Yeah.
And so the Norway killer had his own, you know, individual lunacy, his own schizophrenia, and he had the model, of national schizophrenia, if you will, whatever the psychological term would be. I mean, in 9/11, on 9/11, 3,000 people lost their lives in a terrible tragedy, and so our response was to kill a million people
in Iraq,
or whatever the death toll is.
Well, it's over a million in Iraq and civilians. But then, you see, what fascinates me is, were Rumsfeld and Cheney sociopaths too? Have you thought about that?
Well, I think that probably a case could be made that that's the case, simply looking at the evidence of what they've done. It wouldn't be limited to them. It goes back to, to anybody that has pushed a war, started a war.
But then, of course, you had the American people behind it. In
90% or whatever the total was,
I landed in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, the night before 9/11 to speak to a couple of thousand students at the university.
Okay.
And I'd just come in from Australia, and I got up the next morning and turned on the television and saw the planes going into the towers.
Wow.
And at the university, the campus there, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, is pretty fundamental Christians. And I'm walking across the campus, and a woman had a little booth, and she came up to me and said, "Do you believe in Jesus or something like that?" And I said,
okay,
I'm an atheist. And she psychologically slammed me in the face and said, "You'll go to hell." And I thought, oh my God, what is this about? So then I thought, well, I'd better get out the Bible. And I looked at a few quotations from Jesus, and I started off my lecture by saying, quoting Jesus, love thine enemy and do good to those who hate you, hoping and praying that America wouldn't get into vengeance, but would instead look at the etiology or the driving force of what caused these men to do that horrific crime.
Right.
But instead, the whole country turned into vengeance. Have you thought about that, Bob?
Well, I have thought about that a lot. And one thing I would say is that it's less the whole country than it is the leadership that pushed the button a different kind of leadership, I think, could have done something different.
Taken the country in a different direction.
Yes. I'm from what I'm reading and hearing about, Norway's reaction to its tragedy, it's just far, far different. It's a determination, to maintain their highest values.
Well, just enunciate what Norway's reaction was to the tragedy, Bob Kohler.
Flowers in the street, an incredible outpouring of humanity into the streets of Oslo, a standing together. The crown prince spoke and said the streets are filled with love. We stand for our highest values. No one is left out. No one is excluded. That sort of thing. I mean, it's the opposite of our leadership.
But what was their reaction to the killer?
I'm not sure if I understand what you mean by that.
Well, the Norwegians, do they hate him for killing 78 people, or what is their psychological reaction to him?
I think it's the opposite of that. It's, there's a desire to understand him.
Yeah.
And to, I don't know if forgive is the right word yet. I mean, and I don't want to be simplistic about forgiveness, like, oh, that's okay, you killed 78 people, but that's okay. I mean, it's not like that.
No, it's more to psychologically understand what got him into this position. Is he really deranged? Was he pushed into it by these crazy right-wing Christian ideals? And I thought it was interesting. I'm not sure if you wrote this, Bob Kohler, or someone else, but, when a Muslim does some awful terrorist. It's a Muslim terrorist.
But when a Christian does
something, it's not a Christian terrorist.
No, it's a lone. It's an isolated incident. It's a lone nut.
I know, but it is terrorism, isn't it?
Well, of course it is terrorism. And I would go even further when we, you know, when we send a drone, you know, airplane and bomb a wedding. I think that's terrorism,
too.
Oh,
it's worse than terrorism.
Yeah, worse than terrorism.
It's cold-blooded murder. Now, I want to get on to my friend Rupert Murdoch.
Yes, okay.
You've written about him and quite beautifully in the light of the hacking scandals in Britain now and maybe in the United States. That's part of it, but
right. You
say that's a simplification of actually what Murdoch's been about.
I
now will give you permission to extrapolate on air about your notions of Rupert Murdoch.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean Rupert Murdoch has been, you know, I mean I've had a personal distaste. I mean, distaste isn't the right word. A personal just deep bitterness after he bought the Chicago Sun-Times back in whatever year that was, sometime in the early
80s, yes.
To me, that it was, I mean, the Sun-Times before that, when it was owned by the Marshall Field brothers, was just this feisty, dynamic, investigative paper. It was, you know, whereas the Tribune, the other major paper, was the establishment paper and conservative. This one was out there always, you know, pushing, you know, into the face of power. Lots of incredible investigative reporting, and he turned it into the New York Post. You know,
did he?
Yes, he did.
And now, horrible schlocky tabloid.
Yeah, yeah. I to me, it was a crime against the city.
Yeah.
And so that was my introduction to Rupert. You know, almost thirty years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So. You know, it's hard to avoid following his career. He eventually got rid of the Sun-Times, and, you know, while I don't think the Sun-Times ever fully recovered, it is a much better paper now than it certainly ever was when Murdoch had it. Okay, and so what Rupert Murdoch is known for and what has finally caught up with him is the sleaze, you know, sleazy... pandering, you know, tabloid journalism combined with serious right-wing politics.
Yeah, serious right-wing politics. So it's catering to the lowest common denominator. It's yellow journalists.
Journalism
a la Randolph Hearst, but much worse.
These
naked women everywhere. I mean, it just makes you feel sick.
It's so grotesquely exploitative and. Yeah.
Why don't we have naked men so when the women can be titivated?
I don't know. I don't know, but if there was enough demand for it, I think we would have them.
Well, we're 53% of the population, and we have our own sexual proclivities.
Well, what can I say?
Yeah, we'll
have to talk to Rupert about that. Well, anyway, that's part of it, and that's what he's most known for. But what's shocking is the silent. Murdoch, that simply accumulates power. And it wasn't simply that he was rich and had this media empire and kind of spouted, you know, right-wing politics and all that, but that he was actually, especially in Great Britain, accumulating enormous power to the point where he was considered like the permanent cabinet member. No matter who was in power, Murdoch was always there to be consulted.
Well, he put them into power. I mean,
he put Thatcher
into power. He put Reagan acknowledged that Murdoch helped to put him into power. Let's
Absolutely.
Be frank.
Yes, got, no, that's exactly, that's why he had the power.
He got so rid of our very, very important Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam. He caused the dismissal of him. Then he helped put Fraser into power, a right-wing Prime Minister. I mean, he's done it all over the place for decades.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's like he's the godfather. And that's the silent side of Murdoch and the Murdoch Empire, you know, that, you know, is not well-known, is not well-covered.
Not well-covered, more so.
But, yeah, and And that's, you know, what's horrifying. I mean, there was an AP story shortly after the Murdoch scandal broke that talked about how Tony Blair was on the phone numerous times to Murdoch before committing troops to Iraq. Like, Murdoch was giving the prime minister advice on what to do. And, of course, what was his advice? Of course, we want the war. I mean, Murdoch and the papers wanted the war. Maybe he wanted it partly because he believed it was right, but it can't have hurt that it also... There's nothing like a war to sell newspapers.
Oh, is that really true, Bob Kohler? Is that what journalists know?
I think so. I mean, that was, you know, the famous William Randolph Hearst line. You know, you supply the pictures, I'll give you the war. I mean,
really?
You know, yeah. I mean, this was. I mean that was back at the time of the Spanish-American War, 100 years ago. You know, more than 100 years ago. And, you know, I've never known a major paper that was, you know, was anti-war in any serious way.
Didn't Randolph Hearst orchestrate the Spanish-American War?
I think that is the whole, yes. He pulled the strings and exerted the power and promoted the war and promoted the hatred in his newspaper.
Wicked, wicked. So which wars... Then Bob Kohler, journalist, has Rupert Murdoch promoted to sell his newspapers and his right-wing agenda.
I think that it can be said that he promoted the post 9/11 wars.
Yeah, that's Afghanistan and Iraq. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much he had to do. I mean, Afghanistan would have happened without him, but Iraq was certainly something that he was. When we get Tony Blair talking to Murdoch, you know, prior to committing troops, that's something. I don't know the influence, you know, here in the States, and I think that the influence wasn't at that level. Nonetheless, through Fox News, it was still, you know, enormous.
Yes, I wonder if he participated in the first Gulf invasion with George I. He probably did.
Well, I would think so. I mean,
that needs to be researched and documented.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great question. I mean, to what extent? And now.
Well, now let's talk about Fox News. I want you to tell the audience what, as a journalist, influence you think Fox News has. Why is it doing it? What's its background motivation? What on earth is going on here?
Well, what influence it has, I mean, that gets into the whole, the television influence on the human mind and the increasing habit of more and more people to just have the TV on as the background of their lives all the time.
Cooking their peas, having their bath, having their shower.
Yeah. I mean, having, you know, talking with their kids. But it's always there in the background.
Yeah.
And when the background is then Fox News, which is just cranks out its perspective on everything, you know, and I think it's more insidious when it's in the background than when it's consciously, you know, attention given to it.
It goes through the left brain and deposits in the right brain.
It bypasses any critical mechanism.
No critical thinking.
Yeah, and it just sits there as truth. And people, I mean, life is uncertain. Yeah. Life is a risky and tricky proposition. There are no guarantees. It's not easy for anyone. And so when you get, and what they do is they play the scapegoat game over and over and over. I mean, at least that's part of it. I mean, certainly it's the celebrity fawning and it's, you know, I mean, we are a secular society, but our gods are the celebrities.
It's so pathetic, isn't it? They have these little girls who've just reached menarche, beautiful skins with no wrinkles, and everyone's wondering who they're sleeping with and if they've got a baby bump. I mean, it's salacious pornography, isn't it?
It is. Well, yes, it is. It is pornography, and it's masked as something
pathetic.
Else, so it's even worse.
And they're only really children. I mean, older people who have wrinkles, they're given no time and space to impart their wisdom to the younger generations at all. Let's talk about this Glenn Beck man. I mean, he propagates the sort of thing that happened in Norway, does he not?
Well, yeah. I mean,
let's talk about that.
And Glenn Beck was the guy that afterwards said, well, this, the camp where the shootings occurred, he said, that sounds like kind of like Hitler Youth Camp or something.
Yes.
I mean, he just, put this ugly, libelous label on the the government Labor Party Youth Camp, where 68 young people had just been slaughtered.
I know,
and he also
said initially it was a Muslim terrorist, and so the New York Times even bought into that briefly. So, but I need to talk to you, Bob, about freedom of speech. When you have people like Glenn Beck propagating this sort of paranoid, murderous thinking, vengeance, number one, in a society where anyone can get a gun, and this guy in Norway got his guns from America.
Exactly.
And psychopaths can get guns anywhere. So these people are sort of nurturing the violence within people who are mentally sick in society, number one. Number two, you've got Rush Limbaugh, who's propagating the notion that global warming is a fantasy.
Right.
And he's buying the myth of the skeptics and that Exxon is funding environmental skepticism to the tune of millions and millions of dollars, like the tobacco companies fostered, we don't really know if smoking causes cancer because doubt is the most powerful form of propaganda. So I know that freedom of speech is sacred.
Yeah.
But should we have people with an outreach to millions and millions of people who are scientifically illiterate, let's be frank, telling them lies when the world is on the brink of extinction of many species and including in time possibly the human species? I mean, I think that needs to be debated. What is your take on that, Bob Kohler?
Well, that's a reasonable question. I would say my take on it is if we somehow... Well, freedom of speech, if it's curtailed, they're not the ones that are going to be curtailed.
Why not? No, but I think they're the ones that need to be curtailed.
Well,
we can't have people lying. I mean, look, in medicine, if I lied about medicine, I would be damaging my patients, maybe killing them, and I would be deregistered. You can't lie about science. That is immoral, to say the least, but it's worthy of being locked up in prison, I think. Because the Earth is in such a vulnerable situation now from global warming, from nuclear meltdowns, from genetic engineering. I mean,
I agree with
nuclear
you.
Nuclear war.
I don't know the mechanism by which that could be curtailed.
I don't either.
Because there's so much money behind it.
Yeah, but why is money going to kill the Earth?
Yes. Yeah, it's going to kill the Earth. I don't know the mechanism for curtailing that kind of poison. I agree with you. There is something seriously wrong with it. I don't know what the mechanism is. If it becomes if the mechanism is in some way putting a lid on certain kinds of speech, my sense is that they will surely backfire.
And like prohibition. The
money that is behind the message that we're just talking about will make sure that it will clamp the lid. It will find a way to prosecute, you for your show right now, before it will prosecute Rush Limbaugh. That's my sense.
Yeah, but Rush Limbaugh makes money by getting millions of people to watch his god-awful, really revolting, vile stuff. And and how does he make the money? By people who advertise for people to have antidepressant tablets for their hemorrhoid cream, for their stuff to stick their false teeth on the top of their mouth. I mean, the people who advertise, it's all stuff that people don't need, you know what I mean?
Right.
To get down to the bottom line.
Yeah, I know.
It's so pathetically sort of mindless and going anywhere or producing a better society or getting us to think about real values so our children and our grandchildren have a future, let alone, the leopards that are threatened and the rhinoceros and the elephants and the koalas. I mean, it just makes me feel like weeping and I don't know where to turn.
I agree with you. My belief is that, truth always wins.
Truth always wins, does it? During the Hitler time, did truth win? How many people did he kill?
Yes, I know.
I mean, I say that too. Yeah. The truth rings down the time like a bell, but and people know the truth when they hear it, but they're not hearing it.
I know. I truly don't have an answer to that question, even though I agree with you that there's so much, toxic verbiage out there.
Yeah.
Now, we're talking a lot about, Limbaugh, Murdoch, and the real obvious, I get as upset reading the New York Times half of the time. I don't listen to Murdoch, I don't listen to Limbaugh, except on rare occasions when I can't avoid it.
Right.
Or if I'm researching him.
Right.
But the New York Times is there, and while, they have wonderful stuff and, great cultural stuff, their political writing is horrible, I think, much of the time.
I read it every day, I must say, and I think it's the best newspaper in America. But you think they're still... Their political writing is not good?
Well,
Bob Kohler.
When it's foreign policy, I mean, the New York Times supported the war.
Yes, it did. Judith Miller's 5 front page articles.
Exactly.
For which they later apologized, but it was too late, she cried.
Well, yeah, it was too late. The mea culpas were sort of minor, and there was no indication that there was any lesson learned.
Yes.
The mea culpa, as I understood it, or the apology, was we just couldn't have known any better, but they could have known.
They did know.
There were lots and lots of voices out there that opposed the war that had no, media platform, no large media platform to speak from. I think there used to be such a thing as a liberal media that is the battle cry of the conservatives. Down with the liberal media, and there is no such thing at this point. It's as liberal as Obama is, which is not.
Look at what Obama's done. People are really desperate now at the impasse that's been reached and what he's accepted from the Republicans. I'll tell you an interesting thing, Bob. I'm reading the biography of Obama's mother, who was an absolutely brilliant woman, who was a different woman, went on her own path, an anthropologist who lived in Indonesia for many years. But she was basically a conciliator in her work, dealing with the people that she dealt with in the indigenous people. And that's what Obama is. He's a conciliator. And I'm afraid and very saddened that he's not a leader and he doesn't know how to get the fire in his belly to take on these Tea Partiers who are just leading not just America but the world astray, right?
Right, yes. The most apt metaphor I've heard is that... The Democratic Party, led by Obama, it's got battered spouse syndrome.
Battered spouse,
the Republican Party are the batterers.
Yep.
And when they fall down in a drunken stupor, in other words, when they lose an election, the Democrats will tidy up and try to make things nice and cheerful, you know, for when the drunk wakes and starts getting violent again. And now, as we've noticed, the drunk is awake and violent again. And so, oh, yes, dear, let's, it's accommodation, accommodation.
You know who I thought of this morning? I wish we had Lyndon Baines Johnson back. By God, did he know how to push a deal?
Well, yes, that was in a different era.
And what about FDR? I mean, FDR came from wealth himself, from the aristocracy in New York, and he didn't really care what the capitalists said about him. He just went ahead and did the right thing.
Right. And FDR was pushed from the left.
Yeah.
He didn't want Huey Long to get political power, and Huey Long was pushing socialist, agenda, flaming. And so FDR pushed a more moderate agenda.
Well, Bob Collard, do you think there'll be a backlash or blowback now from the ordinary Americans who are about to lose Medicaid and parts of Medicare and Social Security and their educational... Do you think they'll care?
Oh, my God. You know, I don't know that that's where the blowback is going to come from. I don't know. I just don't know. I don't see it yet.
Yeah.
I don't see it.
No.
Well,
it's a bit early yet, isn't it?
It might be too early.
Yeah.
I think that we have to collapse in the ashes before there will be blowback. What the right wing has done in the last, maybe the last 50 years is nothing short of brilliant in the way it has created a coalition between the social, the cultural conservatives, with the homosexual agenda and all. And all of the stuff that is their agenda, with the corporate and, military industrial.
Well, what about the Koch
agenda?
Brothers?
Koch
or Koch?
I believe it's Koch.
Koch. What about the Koch brothers and these awful people who've... I just read the other day an article where they've got a very finely worked out agenda for all the state governments, these Republican governments, on education and on medical care and on unions. And we saw it most clearly in Wisconsin.
Right,
with that
right.
governor who was, destroying everything. I don't know where... I mean, America still is the most powerful country on Earth, although China's rapidly replacing it. But
And
America's got, all those nuclear weapons still, so it's still the bully on the block, along with Russia.
Oh, I know. I know, there's so many things. There's so many things. There's so many ways where disaster, directions from which disaster could come.
Well, now, for the listeners on this program, and they're wonderful people who listen mostly every week, Bob Collar, where do you suggest they get their information from, the stuff we're talking about now? Where's the best place to go?
Well, I would say don't get it from one source.
Hmm.
Yeah, read the mainstream media and watch, MSNBC or whatever. But go to the internet, go to the sites, challenge the mainstream version of the story. I mean, one of my favorite sites is Common Dreams that has lots of great writing on it. It's a very progressive site. but there's many other sites out there. The fact is that the media empires no longer have a corner on the news.
Because of the internet.
Because of the internet.
Yeah, but there's so much garbage on the internet, you've got to be a real critical thinker to dissect out what is relevant and what is not,
I know. Yes, that's true, too. That is true. It's not like you can trust any site in any factual claim.
No, so you're suggesting people use their powers of critical thinking. There are two other points I want to make. I want to make two points before we end.
Okay.
One is actually, I'm not a progressive. I'm a conservative because I'm for conserving life. And I think we need to turn the euphemisms on their head and say, we are the true conservatives, for we want life to continue on this beloved planet of ours. That's the first thing. The second thing I want you to comment on is, Bob, What's your intuition? Do you think that Fox et al. Did hack into the 9/11 survivors' phones? Uh-huh. Where do you think Murdoch is? If he hacked so vociferously in England, do you think he's been hacking in America?
I would not be surprised if that is the case. That I do. I mean, yes. You're asking for my intuition. My intuition says yes.
Yeah.
There was no moral compunction not to. No ethical compunction not to.
No.
What was to stop them? Mm. You know, except perhaps not being able to. I don't know. But it
if they were able to in England, but if they were able to the royal family's telephone lines,
right?
It's a fascinating story, Bob, in the Australian weekend newspapers last Sunday, which was that there's a magazine in Australia called New Idea, which Rupert bought years ago.
Okay.
And instead of breaking the story of Camillagate, you know, when they hacked into Prince Charles's private conversations with Camilla Parker Bowles about being in her underpants, and I won't go into the details, but you remember all of that, don't you? Tampons and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that story, it was so big, they didn't break it in Britain. They broke it in New Idea in Australia, which gave it the sort of umbrella coverage that it could then go back to Britain and be broken in Britain. Isn't that fascinating?
That is totally fascinating.
And then, I wonder if similar dynamics have been played in the United States. I mean, you don't know.
They have their empire is big, and
massive.
You know, and their moral values are kind of non-existent.
Non-existent.
So they could game the system any way that they could.
Know of a man called Dennis Potter? Dennis Potter was a British man who understood very early on the power of television and how it was absolutely could be brilliantly used to educate people.
Okay.
And he wrote The Singing Detective, which was a brilliant, brilliant television series, The Singing Detective. And he was interviewed 15 years ago. He was by a BBC reporter, and he was dying of pancreatic cancer.
Uh-huh.
And he was in tremendous pain. He had psoriatic arthropathy. He had psoriasis, which is what the Singing Detective had. That's awful skin disease with red skin that desquamates and peels all over the place. And he had arthropathy, which is like rheumatoid arthritis, but his hands were like claws. He couldn't move them. And fixed in one hand was a morphine flask, and he was sipping at that to control the pain of his cancer.
Okay.
And the other claw was a cigarette. And he said, you know, I'm dying. He said, I can drink cream. And he said, there's a tree outside which is the blossomingest blossom tree I've ever seen. He was really getting into life. And then he called his cancer Rupert. And he said that Rupert is the most dangerous man in the world. And that was 15 years ago.
Oh, my God.
He died about 6 weeks later. But that, if you can get onto that interview of Dennis Potter, it's an absolute classic. You know, when you watch something and you want to bottle it and keep it like that and never forget it?
Right.
It was that type of interview.
Wow.
So people have known for a long time, but maybe what's breaking now may break the whole empire apart. What's your intuition on that, Bob?
Well, I think this could be the beginning of a larger collapse that's not going to be limited to the Murdoch empire.
Mm.
I mean, if Murdoch collapses, I mean, what will he bring down with him? And I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. But it could, I mean, I don't know. I think that, you know, this looks like the beginning of some kind of big change.
Mm.
And
one can only hope.
Yeah, one can only hope. And I think all we can do is, you know, keep our integrity, tell the truth, and, you know, show compassion.
And also be always curious.
And be always curious, absolutely.
Now, your book, Courage Grows Strong at the Wound.
Yes.
Who published that and when was it published, Bob Calder?
Well, it came out this past October. It's a small press in Chicago called Xenos Press. It's been out, so maybe about 8 months now. It's sort of the personal and the political fused into a collection of pieces that, begins with the story of, my wife and, her death to cancer.
Mm.
And it's sort of the inner search, my inner search for peace. And then it opens up, there's 9/11 and then there's the outer search for peace. And it ends with, political reflection. The last piece is on the Winter Soldier testimony in Silver Springs, Maryland, a couple of years ago, where Iraq and Afghani war veterans told the truth about the occupation.
Mm. So sounds like a very powerful and timely book, and I would recommend that everyone who can obtain a copy and read it.
Well, thank you. They can go to my website. It's commonwonders.com.
Okay. I think we've run out of time, Bob. I thank you very much for this.
Oh, this is great, Helen. I really enjoyed talking to you. I'm a big fan of yours for many, many years.
Oh,
so
yeah?
It's great to talk to you. And I appreciate all the work, all of the truth you've been telling for so many years on, the terror of, that we face from all of that.
Yeah, well, we'll keep on keeping on, eh?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very, very much, Bob.
You're welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was columnist Bob Calder. If you want to find out more about Bob, go to www.commonwonders.com. If you want to find out about our previous programs, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. If you want to support our very important work at this time, where there's not a lot of freedom in the press, there is a donate button, and we would be incredibly grateful if you would help us maintain this really, I think, very important program. Okay, we'll be back with you with another fascinating program next week, but that's it for now. Bye.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.